Dr. Goodman is seated at the witness table. And Ms. Riccardella, when you're ready, please proceed. Actually, I should swear the witness, Dr. Goodman. Can you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Please go ahead, Ms. Riccardella.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Goodman. Could you please state your name for the record?
Stephen Goodman.
And what is your current position?
I'm a professor of oncology, epidemiology, biostatistics, and pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine.
And would you briefly review your educational background post-high school?
Post-high school. Okay. Going back a long way. I got a BA from Harvard, where I studied applied math and biochemistry. I got an MD from New York University, and then trained in pediatrics at Washington University, St. Louis, was board certified. Then got a master's degree in biostatistics and a PhD in epidemiology from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
And are you a medical doctor?
Yes.
And you're board certified?
Yes.
In what?
Pediatrics.
Okay. And what licenses do you hold?
I no longer hold an active license. I held a license to practice until the late 90s when I surrendered to epidemiology as my real profession.
And would you briefly describe your employment history, your academic employment?
I've been on the faculty of Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in the Department of Oncology with joint appointments in epidemiology and biostatistics since 1989.
And in what professional societies are you most involved?
The one where I'm most involved is the something called the Society for Clinical Trials, where I serve on their executive board. I'm currently editor of their journal, and I'm also a member of the American Statistical Association, the International Biometric Society, and have been a member of a variety of epidemiologic organizations.
Now, your CV states that you are on various advisory committees. Could you explain what your role is on those advisory committees?
Yes, I'm on several. I serve as a scientific advisor to what's called the Technology Assessment Program of the National Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. This is an expert panel of leading scientists and physicians from around the country that looks at new medical procedures, interventions, and tries to decide from emerging evidence whether there's enough evidence to conclude that it works, basically. I served in a similar capacity on the Medicare Coverage Advisory Commission, where they do exactly the same thing. They look at emerging evidence of the efficacy of medical procedures and interventions to decide whether they're likely to work and whether Medicare should cover them. Let's see others. Those are the main ones at present.
And do you hold any teaching positions in your specialty?
Yes, I teach. It's going off. I teach a number of courses in the Department of Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins. I teach a three-term doctoral seminar that's required of all doctoral students on basic principles, so not just basic, advanced principles of epidemiology and issues in inference. I teach a course in meta-analysis, systematic reviews, or evidence synthesis. Taught that for 10 years. I teach a course in clinical research methods, both during the regular term, and I also teach that during the summer. And I also lecture in a number of other courses on ethics of clinical research.
And are you a full professor?
Yes.
And you mentioned that you give lectures. Do you also give lectures to professional groups and organizations?
Yes.
What topics, usually?
They're usually on issues of inference and evidence synthesis, that is, how to draw conclusions from data.
And to whom would you give such a lecture?
I've been invited to many groups, the FDA, the CMS. I've given invited talks to various epidemiologic societies.
And what CMS?
I'm sorry, that's Medicare, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, groups like this, training sessions for staff who have to synthesize evidence.
And do you lecture internationally as well?
Yes, I do.
Are you actively involved in research?
Yes, I am.
Could you explain in what ways?
Well, I have been a member of and now director of a division of biostatistics in our Department of Oncology, and the main role I and fellow faculty there have is to collaborate with other researchers, both in the oncology, in the cancer center, but also throughout the medical school in virtually everything that they study. So we do everything from very basic laboratory research, that is, we don't do it, we work with the scientists who do it, to large-scale epidemiologic studies, and that's where I spend my time when I'm not teaching.
And is epidemiology itself a science?
Yes, it certainly is.
And you've published over 100 scientific articles, is that accurate?
Yes.
And are they all peer-reviewed?
Yes.
And what have been the primary subject areas of your publications, if you could distill it?
Well, the primary areas of the collaborative research is cancer, although I've published articles in many other disease areas as well. My own work tends to be in areas of inference and how to, again, methods and principles underlying how to draw conclusions from usually uncertain data. I've also actually done research on peer review, believe it or not. I think that was peer reviewed too. Those are the main areas.
And in addition, you've authored 6 book chapters, is that correct?
Yes, that's true.
And your CV states that you wrote the lead chapter in the 2004 Surgeon General's report on smoking. Is that?
Yes.
And what did that entail?
That was the chapter that laid out the principles and categories of conclusions that were to be used in the causality assessments in the subsequent chapters, which all focused on specific diseases, links of specific diseases to smoking. But this set out the framework by which, and the principles by which each of the contributing authors would use to make that assessment.
And do you have an editorial role in any medical journals?
Yes, I've been the senior statistical editor for the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is one of the world's leading medical journals since 1987. I'm also editor-in-chief of a journal called Clinical Trials, as I mentioned before, which focuses quite generally on clinical research methodology.
And are you a reviewer for any journals?
Yes, I'm a reviewer for many many journals. I was also associated for another journal, the Journal of General Internal Medicine, for several years.
And Dr. Goodman, have you testified in a court of law before?
Yes, I have.
How many times?
Twice.
And could you describe what those cases were about?
One was a malpractice case in Florida. It had to do with a misdiagnosis, and it was I was called down there as someone who could comment on the evidence underlying the prognostic, the likely fate of the patient had they not had the delayed diagnosis. So it was involved looking at the literature. In the other case, it was the Fen-Phen case, where the tort case, where I was brought in to it after the settlement had been reached. People in the courtroom will know the language better than I. To advise on the fairness and whether the settlement that had been reached was equitable and fair or based in science. So I was given the underlying data they had to reach the settlement and the compensation grid, and I advised the court on whether that was reasonably based on the evidence, underlying evidence.
Have you ever testified in relation to epidemiology and autism?
No, I have not.
Now, Doctor, your CV states that you've been a member of various committees of the Institute of Medicine. Is that correct?
Yes.
What is the Institute of Medicine?
The Institute of Medicine is an independent body that's, I believe it's chartered by Congress. It's a branch of the National Academy of Sciences, which was originally started in the mid-1800s. the Institute of Medicine as an independent entity within that was started, I think, about 1970. And it's a body that is specifically tasked with providing independent, objective, expert scientific advice to Congress and to federal agencies and other official bodies within the U.S. government, but it's completely independent of them.
And how is the Institute of Medicine regarded in the scientific community?
I would say, it's hard to speak for the entire scientific community, but I would say it's one of the most highly regarded bodies, both election to the Institute of Medicine, which is separate from serving on the committees, is one of the highest honors that a scientist, an academic scientist, or practicing scientist could achieve. And their work is very highly regarded, mainly by dint of the quality of the products that it's produced over the years and the quality of the people who work on them.
Do you know how IOM, I'm going to use the acronym IOM,
yeah.
IOM committees are formed?
Well, I've not been on the side of choosing the committees, but since I've been on a few, I have some insight. The IOM staff, which includes the leadership, possibly members of the academy, and staff who worked on a topic, try to find people who they regard as expert or have relevant expertise in a particular area related to the report that they're constructing a panel. They usually have a number of domains of expertise that they try to cover, and they I assume they look through the literature, they look through talking to other scientists, and try to find people who they think are both of high reputation and highly respected to be able to opine or on the various subjects that they address.
So committee members are selected by the IOM?
Yes, they are.
And what is the role of a committee member?
I think that varies by committee. On the committees that I have been, our role has been to read through all the evidence in the form of published reports. We also listen to public testimony and evidence that's presented to us in public session. And it's our job to both come up with the conclusions and drafting of critical language that's in the report. Much of the bulk of the body of the report is written by staff, particularly things like evidence tables but this is guided by the deliberations of the panel, and all of the language is reviewed by all the members of the panel before it's finalized.
Well, that brings me to my next question. Would you briefly discuss the peer review process at the IOM?
Yes. Again, I know this indirectly, but the first of all, the reports go through many rounds of revision before it's sent out for peer review. Once it's sent out for peer review, they identify a panel of scientists. It can be as many as 10 or 15 or 20, and that report is sent to them. They send comments back, and it's the whole process is brokered by a review manager, who's again a usually respected academic. Doesn't necessarily have to be a person who's expert in that specific area, but they're expert in being a fair judge of whether the panel adequately responds to the reviewer's comments. So the panel does not have to agree or change their conclusions on the basis of the review, but they have to offer good reasons for every change they do or do not make. They have to respond to every single comment that's made. And those reviewers are not known to us at the time of the review, nor is the review manager. We have no idea where these are coming from, but ultimately their names are published in the book. That's actually the first time in the report. That's the first time we ever know who read the report. The other thing I will say is after that comes back to the IOM, it then goes through several further levels of review up through the leadership, up to the president of the Institute of Medicine. And it's only when it passes that level that the report is issued.
Now, your CV states that you were on the IOM Immunization Safety Review Committee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Doctor, do you know why that committee was formed?
I think it was formed because of concern by both Congress and also the CDC about a variety of hypotheses that were being proposed, and it was felt that it was extraordinarily important that the evidence underlying these hypotheses be adjudicated or judged in a fair and unbiased fashion, both for the purposes of science and public health, and also because of the concerns of the public. Just that.
And when was it formed?
This committee, well, we first met in 2001. I think obviously the process of formation preceded that by about a year.
And how many members served on the committee?
13, I believe.
Okay. And how many medical institutions were represented on the committee?
I'll have to go back. I think it was 13. Okay. Might have been 10, 12.
From across the country?
Yes.
And in 2001, when the IOM first met, what outcomes were they looking at?
Clinical
outcomes.
Right. You could just look at the sequence of reports. We had a whole series of reports. The very first one was MMR and autism, that is measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and autism specifically. And the second one was on thimerosal, and I believe it's the second one, on and developmental disorders. And then there was a whole range. There was also polio vaccine, SV40, and cancer related to a contamination of polio vaccine. And there was a series of 8 reports, which the final one was re-looking at the MMR hypothesis and autism and the thimerosal hypothesis. Although this time it was specifically on autism, the previous report was on more unspecified developmental problems.
And getting back to the membership of the Immunization Safety Review Committee, do you recall what the specialties were of the individual members generally?
They were, having recently reviewed it, it was we had neurologists, pediatric neurologists, neonatologists, immunologists, epidemiologists, biostatisticians, folks who were expert in issues of risk communication, public health, vaccine biology, and I think that may cover the territory, nursing.
There was no toxicologist on the committee.
No, there was not. When I reviewed it, I saw that there wasn't on this committee. I believe there were toxicologists who may have been among the reviewers, but we didn't have anybody specifically expert in that area.
In your opinion, the fact that there was no toxicologist in the community, did that affect the IOM's conclusion?
No, I don't think it would have affected our conclusions at all.
Now, you've been a member of other IOM committees as well, correct?
Yes.
Could you just briefly state a couple of those?
The first one was Agent Orange and health outcomes in veterans. The one following my service on the immunization safety was the treatment of PTSD in veterans, which is
post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes, which is a big issue these days, as we know.
I'd like to turn the discussion briefly to the 2001 report that the Immunization Safety Committee issued. What conclusions did the 2001 committee make with regard to the hypothesis of thimerosal-containing vaccines causing autism?
That conclusion was that the evidence was inadequate basically to make a judgment on that. And it was on developmental disorders generally. The reason they said that was that there were, at that time, no epidemiologic studies that addressed the question, and that the biologic studies underlying the hypothesis were, as described at the time, fragmentary.
And did the committee recommend that additional studies be done?
Yes, and in fact, they were done.
Now, in 2001, the committee used the phrase biologically plausible, but I note that in the 2004 report, they just changed their phrasing. Could you explain why?
Yes. The phrase biologic plausibility was used, I think, in a somewhat informal and unfortunate way the first time, and it's explained in detail in the last report why it was changed.
You mean the 2004 report?
Yes, in the 2004 thimerosal autism report, or vaccines and autism. It was originally used in the sense of just saying that this is possible. It doesn't violate physical principles. That is, we knew that mercury is a neurotoxin. There's no question that it's a neurotoxin. So the idea that it could produce some form of neurologic disease was not impossible, not at all impossible. So it was used in this sort of technical sense that, as opposed to biologically implausible, that is, or biologically impossible, that it didn't violate any known biologic or physical principles or rules. And that was the only sense in which it was used. It then became apparent to the committee when the report was received that this phrase was inappropriately vague and nonspecific, and that it was taken by many it was interpreted by many as saying that the hypothesis was likely or probable, which wasn't in no way the sense that it was used. So the committee decided in later reports, actually decided even in the next report, to be much more precise about how it was evaluating the biologic evidence. And it lays this out in the 2004 report. First of all, they refer specifically to biologic mechanism, and then they divide it into three categories. They divide the description of the biologic mechanism into it being theoretical only, and this might be the realm in which biologically plausible could fall. Theoretical would be an explanation that could be true, that hasn't been demonstrated in any experimental settings, but it's not impossible and could rise to the level of now we should test it. So that would be theoretical. It's not, you wouldn't deem something theoretical if it was completely a crackpot theory. So it had to at least rise to some minimal level of credibility to be theoretical, but it would still be theoretical. It would be just something that was posed as a possibility worthy of exploration. Then there was experimental, which is maybe pieces of the mechanism had been demonstrated, but by no stretch of the imagination had the entire mechanism been demonstrated. And so we could judge something as experimental if there was enough of the causal pathway there shown in the laboratory or in other clinical experiments. And we would rate that then as weak or strong. And then finally, there was, I think it was proven or demonstrated that you actually could show in a human being that such and such an exposure caused this outcome with virtual certainty. And an example of that was Guillain-Barré syndrome shown in a person who was re-challenged with the same exposure, with the same vaccine, and continually would get it. So that was those are the possibilities of mechanistic categorization. So we were much more explicit in all subsequent rounds to make sure that the public would understand the distinction between biologic hypotheses, which were speculative, worthy of pursuit, versus mechanisms that were empirically shown and accepted.
Now, the committee met again in 2004. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Why was it convened again?
Well, the main reason, aside from continuing concern over these particular hypotheses, that is both the MMR and the thimerosal autism hypothesis, one of the main reasons was that there was now a moderate amount of epidemiologic evidence that had come in since 2001. So it was felt that this subject deserved further attention. There was now more evidence, or I should say evidence, to consider, and they wanted us to weigh in on that. We, by the way, the panel itself did not decide what topics we were to address. This was decided at higher levels, and we were told that this is what you will be studying, this 6 months.
And what was the clinical outcome that was specifically studied by the 2004 committee?
Autism.
And by autism, do you mean autism spectrum disorders?
Yes, both. Both that and autistic disorder.
And what were the types of evidence that were presented to the 2004 committee?
I think we saw quite a range of evidence. We saw the epidemiologic evidence. We were also presented with an array of laboratory, animal, clinical type studies that related to the hypothesis.
Was the public invited to comment as well?
Yes, we had public session.
And did you have letters presented as well?
Yes, we did.
Now, Doctor, what were the possible causal conclusions that were available to the committee in 2004?
Those were a causal connection is proven. The evidence favors a causal conclusion. I should actually look in this will come very, very close. It favors a causal conclusion. The evidence is inadequate. Meaning it's too weak or conflicting or sparse to make a conclusion. OMS left out one. There's no evidence, so that's a possible conclusion. There's simply no evidence. So that's separate from inadequate evidence. So no evidence establishes a causal conclusion, favors a causal conclusion, inadequate for a causal conclusion, and favors rejection of a causal relationship.
And what's the conclusion that the committee reached in 2004?
It concluded that it favored rejection of this hypothesis.
Was that a unanimous decision among all committee members?
Yes, it was.
And when is this favors rejection category typically utilized?
It's used, well, this is a signal case. It's used when all the evidence points away from a causal relationship and there's no countervailing biologic or mechanistic evidence that in any way would contravene that evidence. I have to be very, very clear, and it was stated very clearly in the report. It absolutely doesn't mean that it absolutely rules out the possibility of a relationship. That's actually almost literally impossible to do unless you show that something is physically impossible. And we'll talk more about the nature of epidemiology and epidemiologic results and why it makes it very difficult. So it's really just a verdict or a conclusion that says the weight of the evidence is on one side and points away from a conclusion. I would say that we felt it was very, very important to say that because we felt that we were speaking to the public and as well as to the public health agencies. But there were many, many very, very concerned parents who were facing vaccination of their children that time. Actually, I had a child who was exactly that age, and exactly when we were doing this report, I had to decide on vaccination. And there were parents who had children who were autistic, who for whom conclusions like this could have a tremendous emotional impact because they had their child vaccinated. So we were aware that we had to speak to what we think the evidence really pointed to, because there were real high stakes for the parents as well as the public health community, and we couldn't get caught up too much in technical quibbles when the evidence pointed in one direction or the other.
Do IOM committees frequently come to that conclusion?
No, they generally don't. They did a few times in the Agent Orange arena, but usually the conclusions range from inadequate to, you know, favors acceptance. They usually don't come out and say favors rejection, but I've not done a census of all the reports.
Now, Doctor, it's been said that the IOM committee recommended that no additional resources be used to explore a causal relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism. Is that an accurate characterization of the IOM's?
No, that's not accurate at all.
What did the IOM say about further resources?
I could read from the report. What we felt was that the real problems in the study of autism had to do with the fact that we did not understand the biology and the risk factors for autism very well, that it was very, very hard to even design epidemiologic studies that would target any groups, if there were groups, that might be at higher risk, and that it to continually go back over and over looking at these studies of general population exposure and autism outcomes was, A, likely to produce the same results that the previous studies had done, and two, it would divert. I mean, these studies are incredibly expensive. So for every $1 million or $2 or $3 million that's spent on these large epidemiologic studies, looking again at large populations, that's that amount of money that's not spent looking at the biology of autism, which we didn't understand, and at the risk factors for autism, that we thought would yield a greater understanding. We did also think that once we had more knowledge from those sort of studies, looking at the causes and biology of autism, we could return to the field and design more intelligent, if it was indicated, more focused epidemiologic studies, if there was a plausible route to go. So we didn't say that money should be withdrawn. I think the exact language is something very close to, we think it should be funneled towards the most promising areas. And in the absence of understanding the fundamental biology of autism, it's very, very difficult to advance the science. So it was an issue of prioritization.
Okay. Excuse me. Now, Doctor, you're an epidemiologist, correct?
Yes.
What is epidemiology?
It's the science of patterns, with the determinants of patterns of disease in populations and what we'll call the risk factors for those patterns, the determinants of those patterns.
And what role does epidemiology play in the community?
Well, it's the only science that looks at an exposure and an outcome, at the patterns, the population patterns of exposure and outcomes in humans. And it's actually epidemiologic studies or epidemiologic type designs are what undergird virtually all knowledge in medicine. And when you look at the medical literature, almost every paper you read, short of a case report, a single case report, can be categorized as some form of observational studies. Of course, epidemiology can also be said to include experimental studies. Sometimes those are separated off. Experimental meaning somebody actually manipulates the exposure.
Now, is any epidemiologic study perfect?
Perfect Well, if the question is, can they be subject to reasonable criticism? Absolutely. And the reason is, and I'm going to talk about epidemiology as observational studies. So observational studies are looking at the world as it is, looking at smokers who smoke, not who are assigned to smoke, and looking at people who don't smoke because they don't smoke, and try to decide whether the differences in their outcomes are due to the differences in that exposure that they either chose, was chosen for them, or just happened to them. The difficulty in epidemiology in all observational designs is to figure out whether the differences you see in the outcomes are due to the difference in that exposure or something about the people themselves that determine the exposure or is linked to the exposure. So, for example, if all tall people smoked and all short people didn't, in theory, we couldn't necessarily distinguish the effect of height from the effect of smoking when we looked at outcomes. So there's always that residual question or doubt. In the example I just gave, you would begin to address it by looking at other studies where maybe there was a mix of tall and short people, or making the argument that tallness and shortness doesn't really make any sense. So I'm going to downweight that as a possible explanation, although you would, of course, want to do studies, measurements to confirm that, in fact, tallness or shortness was an unlikely and implausible explanation. So every study can be subject to a criticism of this form in one way or the other. And in the end, the way epidemiologists have to approach this is doing multiple studies done in different ways, in different populations, sometimes measuring in different ways. And what you hope and what is believed in the field, in fact, quite a lot of health policy and many things we do would depend on this, is that the kinds of what we will call bias that any one study is prone to is not reproduced in exactly the same way in all the other studies. In fact, this is one of the foundational principles. So we try to do studies, each of which address a relationship in a way that where the amalgam of evidence is such that alternative explanations become increasingly unlikely.
Is epidemiology about statistics only?
No, statistics are obviously a very, very central and important part, but it's a marriage of the numbers that go with the counting in the populations with an understanding of underlying biology, which allows you to design the study in the first place. You wouldn't even know where to start if you didn't have some sense of how what's a relevant exposure, what's a relevant gene, what are the mechanisms, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you go into it not understanding those completely, but you have to have some sense of underlying biology. It also helps you decide when you get, unexpected findings, which happens every day, the journals are filled with them, which ones are likely to be spurious and which ones are not. The ones that are likely to be spurious are the ones for which the underlying mechanism is opaque, unlikely, or completely absent. Every once in a while we may be surprised. But there are a lot of... But biologic understanding is in every piece of an epidemiologic study from the moment you decide on the exposure, the patients, or the subjects, the outcomes, to the other side when you're analyzing the data.
What is required before an epidemiologist can reliably make a causal inference between an exposure and an outcome?
To make a causal determination, well, I pretty much outlined it. You want to see a relationship that's beyond the play of chance in a variety of studies. You want to see a relationship that's where the at a minimum doesn't violate any biological or physical rules and at a maximum actually has a coherent biologic explanation behind it. The larger the relationship, the less you might rely on the underlying biologic mechanism. So in the case of smoking, which is one of the signal epidemiologic triumphs, the relationship was so strong and so compelling that even though they didn't understand completely at the time exactly how smoking caused lung cancer, it was very, very hard to resist the relationship, and it was seen in so many populations. It was very hard to construct plausible competing explanations for what was being seen. And there was some laboratory and mouse and other evidence that made it plausible. But in most cases, as the relationships that you see are weaker, if they're still, they have to be beyond the play of chance. The corresponding biologic explanation has to be that much stronger. So it's sort of a marriage between the strength of what we'll call the counting evidence and the strength of the explanatory evidence behind it. The weaker the counting evidence, again, still it has to be beyond the play of chance. The stronger the underlying biologic theory has to be.
Doctor, why is epidemiology particularly suited to addressing questions such as the relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism?
And I actually want to go back to the previous question a second, but I'll restate this question.
Certainly. Why is epidemiology particularly suited to the question that's before the court today, a relationship between thimerosal-containing vaccines and the outcome of autism?
Because it's the only science where it looks, as its exposure, thimerosal exposure, and as its outcome, autism. This is the science that looks at that. Any other science is going to involve a much smaller piece of that chain and involve some sort of speculation about what the other pieces might be that aren't being studied. But it's only epidemiology looking at patterns in humans, in human populations, where we really address this, the central question that we faced in the committee and that I gather is faced today, which is, if a human being is exposed to thimerosal, is there a higher risk of autism at the other end? I can't think of any other methodology that one would use to address that complete question in human beings.
Now, it's been said that there's a dichotomy between laboratory science, and epidemiology. And I believe you said earlier that epidemiology is itself a science, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Now, you wanted to go back to
you said, what do we need to make a causal conclusion? So I said it had to be beyond the play of chance, and I just wanted to tie in my previous answer, and you had to effectively rule out alternative explanations for that observed relationship, which we do, as I previously explained, by doing many different kinds of studies in different ways.
Now, there was a lot of information presented to the IOM in 2004.
Yes.
But how many epidemiologic studies alone did the IOM consider in 2004?
I think it was 5 or 6.
And how many epidemiologic studies have come out since the IOM in 2004 issued its report?
I think it's 4.
Now, getting back to the conclusion that the IOM made in 2004, was it the strength of the evidence that led you to conclude that it favors rejection? Is that my understanding?
Well, it was a combination of the strength of the epidemiologic evidence and the absence of any laboratory or mechanistic evidence that that would controvert that conclusion.
Doctor, I'd like to talk about Dr. Greenland's opinion that he has rendered in this litigation. Have you read his report?
Yes, I have.
It's been filed in the King case as Petitioner's Exhibit 4 and the Mead case as Petitioner's Exhibit 18?
Yes.
And did you listen to his entire testimony he gave in court last week?
I did.
What do you understand his opinion to be in this litigation?
I think it can be, well, I'll refer first to his written report and then his testimony, simply that the existing epidemiologic studies don't rule out the possibility that there's some subgroup, a small subgroup, that could be at elevated risk due to thimerosal, and that the epidemiologic studies, in a sense, dilute the effect that might be seen in that subgroup by including a large number of other subjects whose risk would not be raised by thimerosal. And it really just comes down to that. He just says that that is possible, and I don't disagree with that. I could have written it myself. In his testimony, he... I'll let you ask questions. So that was as far as he went in his written report.
And is he? Do you understand him to now be limiting his opinion to a possible subgroup known as what he terms clearly regressive autism?
Yes, that's how he specified it in the report.
In his testimony as well?
Yes.
Now, Doctor, in your report, you talk about mathematical bounds in epidemiology. Could you please explain what mathematical bounds are?
Well, they can apply to any number. The bounds that he calculated were basically the approximate limits for how high a risk might be in that subgroup that's still compatible with the largely negative evidence that he actually acknowledged in his report. That was the other thing I meant to say, that he did not contest the overall summary of the evidence as put forth by the IOM committee, and nor did he take issue with that in his testimony when he said overall he felt that the elevated risk, or it's the risk due to thimerosal in the general population, was small or nil. So he specified that. And the mathematical bounds refer to, with the residual uncertainty, there's always uncertainty in any estimate. For example, if there was zero, if we knew absolutely for sure there was zero effect, which I think is quite likely, but we don't know it for sure. Out of any epidemiologic studies or combination of epidemiologic studies, what we would expect to get is a effect estimate of zero. That's what we would see with, you know, plus or minus something. So someone can always look at the plus or minus and say, aha, there's room in that plus or minus for somebody to fit in there.
Is that what Dr. Greenland's doing in this litigation?
Effectively, yes. So there is, but I want to make the point, even if the point estimate, that is our best guess of what the risk is exactly zero, there's always going to be some imprecision around that. By definition, we use finite populations. Even though the populations looked at here were in the hundreds of thousands, there's always some residual uncertainty, and so you can always, by definition, say that you haven't ruled out the possibility of a positive effect. The only way you can literally rule out the possibility of a zero effect is to prove the existence of a protective effect. That's the only way mathematically we could do it. So it's always going to be the case if we get mathematical estimates that include a zero effect, that will go a little bit further, and we can fit a high-risk small subgroup in that and say, ah, we couldn't see them. So what he did is he took the upper limits on what are called the confidence intervals, or the precision around various estimates, and he did this for studies individually. And he said, well, if clearly regressive autism only makes up a small portion of the population, and I think he first used 10%, and then Dr. Fumbone suggested 6%, but it's not that important. You could fit in an elevated risk in that small group and still be consistent with the evidence, because the evidence has that imprecision, even though it actually, given the confidence intervals we have right now, they don't go much above a zero effect, or much above one being the rates are equal in two groups. So that's basically the argument he makes, that it's mathematically possible, and that mathematics is correct. It's algebra. I could say the same thing. So where he doesn't go and which is really the point of my report, is from the possible to the probable. That is, it's one thing to say it could be true, but where we really want to go and what the IOM committee felt it had to opine on was, is it likely? And that's where we came down on the other side. And he actually does not offer an opinion in his court as to whether it's likely. And when you asked him whether what his specific opinion was, he said he had no opinion one way or the other. So he was being, that was exactly right. He wasn't opining on whether it's likely or not, only that it was possible. So I thought his answer to that question was quite reasonable and expected.
Now, in your report, you talk about the way in which the confidence intervals are two-sided, and I believe you touched on it, but could you explain what you mean by being two-sided?
Right. So the confidence intervals are the imprecision. They give the range of true relationships that are consistent with the data. They go up above zero or zero effect, and they go down below. So one could equally say, just based on math alone, that a strongly protective effect, or a protective effect, is also possible. It's equally as possible as a risk, as an excess risk. So the math itself, just alone, doesn't differentiate between the plausibility of a strongly protective effect and the risky effect. And what's of interest is almost all the studies, the largest studies, show as their best guess, surprisingly, an effect in the protective direction.
You're
a little bit.
The studies that have been done looking at the relationship between thimerosal and
the epidemiologic studies. Most of them show estimates showing some degree of protection. Now, do I necessarily believe that? No, I don't necessarily believe it's protective of autism, because I don't think that that's particularly, I don't think there's any biologic basis for saying, you know, you would want that the exposure to mercury in that form would protect you against autism. So the reason we don't say it's protective is partly because we don't believe that it has, you know, very strong biologic plausibility. But we say that in lieu of saying it actually favors protection, at least we don't think that it causes excess risk. That is, we think it favors no effect at all. And that's, again, what the IOM committee said.
So, Doctor, taken together, what do the epidemiological studies demonstrate with regard to a purported autism epidemic in this country related to thimerosal-containing vaccine?
Well, again, here Dr. Greenland and I are in accord. He said that any effect due to thimerosal would be nil or small, and all the epidemiology having to do with the rates aside, the epidemiologic studies looking at the effect of thimerosal do basically rule out large increases. What they don't rule out, again, are these very small, you know, subgroups, but you can't have it both ways. So they make thimerosal as a possible cause of a many-fold increase in autism virtually impossible.
Now, in your report, you state that Dr. Greenland's argument requires that thimerosal only raises the risk of regressive autism, or even regressive autism, with no effect on any other form of autism.
That's right.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, so this is an example of of how one can do math. So he calculated these bounds, saying, well, let's imagine that this exposure just raised the risk of regressive autism, which we'll say makes up something between 5 and 10% of the population. So that excess could be swamped by no effect in the rest. And so the effect estimate in the population could fit into this little bit of uncertainty about, you know, could it go slightly in the positive direction. But that calculation that he did, and again, he acknowledged this in his testimony, assumed that it had all its effect only for children with clearly regressive autism and zero effect in the other 90 to 95% of the population. Because if you had some of it, you wouldn't even have to have all of the effect in the population. You have a fivefold effect in one group and maybe just a twofold effect in the rest of the population. Well, then you would see that. We would have seen that in the epidemiology. So this speculation, this calculation, to the extent it has an applicability to the real world, absolutely requires that most or all of the elevated risk is restricted just to this one subtype, and none of that excess risk is shared by anybody else. So he's positing really a dramatically different causal pathway, in a sense, that it's only a trigger for this, it's not a trigger for that. And just that. So that's the basis for his calculation. As soon as you start to allow a little bit of extra risk for everybody else, then that's basically ruled out by the epidemiology, because that would be revealed in the general population patterns. So that distinction, as I pointed out in my report, to be a starter requires some sort of biologic or mechanistic justification as to why in regressive autistics we would have a very, very different causal pathway. They have a fundamentally different biology than children who don't present with that phenotype, and he doesn't present any evidence to that effect. And in his testimony, he said he didn't know of any evidence to that effect. So whether that's possible, I guess it remains in the theoretical realm, mathematical realm. Possible, it's possible. Whether it's probable, well, there was no evidence presented. And again, this is what the IOM committee had to deal with, exactly this sort of argument. This was acknowledged in the report as something that always, the kind of argument that can always be made.
Now, Dr. Greenland, in his report and during his testimony, he used the analogy of cancer.
Yes.
As an example of a broad disease category within which exist distinct types of cancer,
right,
that have different causes.
Right.
Is this a proper analogy to use?
Well, it's a great analogy to use because it absolutely supports my point. Well, let's just look at leukemia. I think he mentioned leukemia. If you asked me, as you asked him, can you distinguish biologically between a child with regressive autism and a child with non-regressive autism? Is there any test you could do, any x-ray, anything, any evidence? Now, he's not an expert in autism, but he said no, he didn't know if he could do that, and the literature does not say that we can do that. So those two subtypes are not distinguishable biologically. If you said to me, can you distinguish lymphocytic leukemia from myeloid leukemia? I would say, well, yes. Lymphocytic leukemia affects lymphocytes. You can look at a slide. That's where it gets its name. Non-small myeloid leukemia affects myeloid cells. You can look at a slide. We know the biology of lymphocytes. We know the biology of myeloid cells. It's completely plausible, in fact, expected, that the risk factors, the course, the treatments, all the clinical features of those two diseases would be different. And in fact, they are. We observe that they are. There are many, many aspects of those two diseases that are different. If you ask me the difference between bronchogenic carcinoma and non-small cell lung cancer, all you have to do is go to the pathologist to say, if you ask the question, are they biologically different? Yes. They're biologically different. They affect different cells in different places. So if you ask the question, are those biologically different? Can you tell me biologically what's different, doctor, about that form of cancer from that form of cancer? I would be able to explain it. And that's what makes different risk factors, different course, different treatments completely plausible in the cancer realm. We don't have the same situation in the autism realm. There may be a day when we understand it better and we do understand what the classifications are. They may have nothing to do with how it presents. It may have things to do with things that we can't even imagine today. So the key issue is, is there any evidence that these two forms, we'll just call them regressive and non-regressive, we won't consider those with epilepsy and those with not, or those with more severe problems or those with not, we'll just consider that particular phenotype, is it causally different? That is there reason, strong reason to believe that there's a different, completely different causal pathway such that this alleged purported risk factor would cause a high risk in one and zero risk in the other? Our understanding is not there. There's no current evidence that that's the case. I cannot predict what we'll know in the future.
Doctor, your report discusses what the results would likely be if a meta-analysis of the studies had been done.
Yes.
First of all, what is meta-analysis?
Meta-analysis has two parts. One is a quality assessment, that is a systematic and close look at the studies themselves. And then if you deem them to be combinable, it's really just, in a sense, an adding up of the studies. And the precision of the combined estimate is almost always more precise than either study taken alone. So if we have situations like we have here, where you have lots of estimates that are just a little less precise than you want, if you can justify their pooling, then your combined estimate will be much closer to, the plus or minus will be a lot tighter than it would be if you just look at them separately. And so that's what meta-analysis is.
So when you discuss what would likely be if a meta-analysis of the epidemiological studies that have looked at thimerosal-containing vaccines in autism, what would a meta-analysis likely show?
Well, it would because most of the point estimates in the largest studies were under one, they would show that the upper bounds, those upper confidence limits, which Dr. Greenland took separately, were probably a lot closer to one than they look like when you look at the studies separately. That said, the reason the IOM committee didn't do that is because there can always be challenges to, well, exactly how comparable is this study to that study? And can you really literally add them up? So as soon as you get into that exercise, you invite those criticisms. So what you can say qualitatively is, again, when you see a whole series of studies done in different ways, that have limits that are only slightly above or moderately above one, you can say that combining them will make them more precise and probably the upper limits closer to one or closer to a zero effect. But we didn't do that quantitatively because you'll get lots of arguments over exactly where that upper limit is. And given that the evidence did not show a relationship, we didn't need to do that to come up with the conclusion that it favored no relationship.
Now, Dr. Greenland did not file a rebuttal report in this litigation, but he did offer some criticisms of your report when he testified orally here last week. And one of the criticisms that he said was that you failed to account for potential problems of the studies that you cited in your report, that you presented no further analysis to show that the studies ruled out subtype effects. Do you have any comments as to that criticism?
Well, first of all, as he said, and we all know, that these subtype effects were not measured in those studies, so I couldn't do those analyses. But on the other hand, no evidence was presented that would make those subtype effects likely or plausible. So it's true that one cannot literally rule out that possibility. But the question is, what is the evidence that makes it likely in the first place?
And
he didn't offer any evidence to rebut. So it still remains, as I said before, it is possible, certainly mathematically possible, whether it is likely or probable based on what we know, both biologically and the limitations of what we know. That's another question upon which he did not opine. So he didn't, in the end, in spite of my not showing specific evidence against that possibility, when asked directly, he said he had no opinion one way or the other. So he actually didn't offer that his conclusion, based on his on the speculation that it might exist, resulted in a likely or probable conclusion that it did.
Now, during his testimony last week, Dr. Greenland also took issue with the example in your report of PETA's analysis of astrologic signs.
Yeah.
He was saying that TCVs have no resemblance to astrologic signs, and he called it rhetorical nonsense. Could you explain whether you think that that analogy is relevant to this litigation?
Well, I don't know about the rhetorical nonsense, but I'll explain about the example. He said, and he's right, that it's a famous example, and it's a famous example for a very good reason. It illustrates a foundational principle about why you have to have biologic plausibility to make a finding credible. So the basic principle underlying that example, and it was somewhat different than here, I'll explain why in a second, was that they had this study that looked at treatments for, it was heart disease, and they did this analysis that showed a subgroup effect, that it showed it had no effect in, I think, 11 of the astrologic signs, and all of the effect was grouped under Virgo, or what, I can't remember what exactly I said in my report, but one of the astrologic signs, and they did this twice. And this obviously is not true. And they presented it this way to basically discourage people from looking for subgroup effects in an overall population that didn't have any strong biologic foundation. But what was different about that situation than here, so that was the principle that was being demonstrated. It didn't matter that it was in a clinical trial. It didn't matter that there were multiple subgroups. The point was, in that situation, there was actually evidence, that is, you actually could look at the relationship under Libra or Virgo and see that it's, you know, a certain size, and look under all the others and see that they're zero. But you wouldn't believe it, and you would think it's implausible because there's no biologic underpinning, there's no support. In this case, it actually doesn't even advance to that point, because it isn't the case that we have evidence, empirical evidence of a relationship that we say we're going to believe or not believe based on the biology. We don't see anything. And the contention is, well, maybe you'd see something if you divided things up, if you looked at the subgroup. So we don't even have that subgroup to look at. That's acknowledged. But the question has to be, well, even before you do that, what's the strength, you know, what biologic reason would you have to make that distinction in the first place? Like, what biologic reason could you have to make between the various astrologic signs? So so that was the point. The point was that the math doesn't tell the story all by itself, that you must look at the cogency, the empirical support of and the mechanism underlying any patterns that you see. Again, in this case, we actually don't have a pattern that we have to explain away because it's not biologically plausible. We actually don't have a pattern, and what's being claimed is maybe there's something underneath that pattern that we don't see. Maybe there's a subgroup for which no biologic evidence is offered. So the point of the example was simply to say that it is very important to have some degree of biologic, mechanistic rationale to support a hypothesis, even to begin exploring it. And that just puts it in the realm of the possible. And then you look for information that puts it in the realm of the probable.
Now, Dr. Greenland also said during his testimony that it's unscientific to assert that there are no differences in mechanisms when there is no understanding of the mechanism. And he accused you of invoking fictional scientific principles, that you were presenting absence of evidence as if it were evidence of absence. Is that what you're doing here, Doctor?
I don't think so. I am completely open to this being empirically demonstrated, if it ever is. He raised it as a possibility if the scientific community takes this hypothesis seriously enough, and it might take it serious enough simply because there's so much concern about it. This for the same reason that they took the thimerosal autism hypothesis seriously in the first place, even though there wasn't much biologic evidence to suggest that it was true. But just the concern about it often generates the need to, you know, go out and do a study that specifically addresses that. But I would say that it's a curious statement when one is positing no evidence for it to say that it stands and is probable because somebody else cannot offer any concrete evidence against it. The fact is, we do have evidence from overall populations that shows no effect. That's very much like what we see in medicine when we do clinical trials and we try a therapy, and you know, 60% of people survive in one group and 40% of people survive in the other group. We say that therapy works. It is always possible for someone to come in and say, "Oh, it doesn't apply to this kind of person." Generally, what we find, particularly when there's no biologic reason to say why that person is different, very, very frequently in medicine, we find that these claims of subgroup effects don't hold up. And this has been empirically studied. So when we have consistent demonstrations in overall populations and no compelling or demonstrated biologic distinction between members of those populations, we generally accept the population average as the most likely one. It does not rule out the possibility, again, I just said from the start, that there could be a different effect among members of that population. But I don't think it's very fair to ask that there be specific rebuttal of that when there's no evidence yet for it. Whether this hypothesis is strong enough to merit going out and spending money and mounting the studies to explore it is a very reasonable question that I'm sure the scientific community will take up, and maybe this study will be done. But I don't believe that the hypothesis remains likely or probable in the absence of evidence against it, particularly with no biologic supporting evidence. It remains as a hypothesis that is not specifically, as a possible hypothesis that as yet is not specifically rebutted by the extant evidence, that is true. But it didn't say that it couldn't be true or that it had specific evidence against it, except against this general background of invoking subgroup effects when there's no compelling subgroup biology as of yet.
So does Dr. Greenland, in this litigation, does he state that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause clearly regressive autism?
No, he did not.
Does he state that thimerosal-containing vaccines are even a most likely cause of clearly regressive autism?
I don't believe he said that, no.
Does he even establish that clearly regressive autism is a disorder category that is recognized by the scientific community as having a different biology or different causal determinants?
No, he said that he could offer no evidence to that effect.
And does Dr. Greenland offer any evidence that thimerosal-containing vaccines elevate the risk of clearly regressive autism?
No, he didn't.
Finally, Doctor, why are you testifying in this litigation here today?
Yes, well, some people ask why I served in that committee, too. This is clearly an area of tremendous concern, tremendous amount of heat. But if scientists looking fairly at the evidence, absent the crucible of concern, and don't speak out looking at it objectively, actually seeing the evidence, I feel like in some way they're not doing their job. They're not serving the vast majority of people who very much want to do the best thing for their child, and simultaneously for those parents who have autistic children want to feel like it wasn't something they did that caused their child's autism. And so I think, I feel that it'd be very easy to duck these kinds of activities. But it wouldn't serve the public health, and it wouldn't serve the really very sincere concern of parents on all sides, to not say honestly what we think is the most likely message from the evidence that occurs today. And at the same time, help, and this is what we did through the IOM, not necessarily here, point the way for further research that might elucidate the causes and cures or treatments of this really very, 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 very difficult disease. So I think just that.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
All right, do the petitioners have any questions for this witness?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Williams, please go ahead.
Can I have just 5 minutes to get organized a little bit?
Certainly you may. We'll take a 5-minute recess.